Show me a prison. Show me a jail. Show me a prison man whose face is growing pale. And I'll show you a young man with many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me an alley. Show me a train. Show me a hobo who sleeps out in the rain. And I'll show you a young man with many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me the whiskey that stains on the floor. Show me a drunken man as he stumbles out the door. And I'll show you a young man with many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I. Show me a country where the bombs had to fall. Show me the ruins of the buildings once so tall. And I'll show you a young land with so many reasons why. And there but for fortune may go you or I, or I.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to the debate, Does Spying Keep Us Safe? Four people debate the motion, Spy on Me, I'd Rather Be Safe. For the motion, Stuart Baker and Richard Falkenrath. Against the motion, David Cole and Michael German.
Stuart Baker. A point where I think we do agree. Of course, the government should, wherever possible, be put to reasonable suspicion before it looks into individual activities. That is true even of the NSA program, which is the one that you have chosen as the poster child for this issue. No one is allowed to search this data without a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And the question I thought was an excellent one, why would you do that if there's an alternative? And the problem is there's not a good alternative. The alternative would be to leave it with the companies and search it there when we have some reason to be concerned about that individual phone number. But the companies get rid of that data on their own schedule. They've got no obligation to keep it, and they don't.
Okay, right down front.
My name is Shelley. I'd like to talk to the point of what data mining means to our privacy and our safety. I have to admit that whenever I hear a government person say, trust me, I get very skeptical about what they are doing.
David Cole, take that.
I mean, the same logic that gave them access to the phone records would give them access to your email records, to your internet records, to your bank records, to your email, your phone location data. And the danger is you put all that information together and they can determine everything about us. They can know more about us than our closest friends know, than our spouses know. And the only thing that, if you give them all that data, then the only thing that's stopping them from doing that are these so-called back-end safeguards, which were routinely violated by the NSA. And we didn't have any opportunity to debate as to whether they were adequate or not because they were put in place entirely in secret.
Richard Falkenrath.
That you just described, they can put all this together. They can understand
the government.
Yeah, that sounds a lot more like Google than the government. And you have to take this. This actually is a serious point. This is not the case that the government is tracking everything you do and can put it all together. And the government doesn't care what you're doing. There actually, though, in the last 10 years with the explosion of social media, is this what you just described emerging in the private sector, with a legal basis being a document which no one can really read and give informed consent to. Unlike the program we're talking about, which is subject to extreme safeguards, rooted in the Constitution, backed up by both chambers of Congress and by the judiciary. And it's the private sector, if anything, which is emerging as the they in your scary scenario.
Well, the fact that the private sector may threaten our privacy is not a justification to allow the government to invade our privacy for two reasons. One, we can establish limits on the private sector. But two, there are lots more reasons to be concerned about the government having access to this information than the private sector having it. And that's reflected in our Constitution, which constitutionally limits government access to data, does not constitutionally limit private access to data. There's a reason for that, and it's a good reason.
Okay, right up here. If you can stand, please. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Jamie. It seems to me the central issue here is a reasonable suspicion. So my question is the massive surveillance that has been on debate here necessary to ascertain whether someone is a reasonable suspicion or not?
Let me try this one.
Stuart Baker.
No one looks at these numbers without reasonable suspicion. That's the standard that is required by some of the safeguards, not all of them, but some of the safeguards that are already built into this program.
And Stuart, just to clarify, so that means the data is available, but nobody actually goes and looks at it.
Right. Okay. That's right. So the only difference between a standard law enforcement search and the searches we're talking about in the context of NSA is they gathered the information first and put it in a database, but didn't search it without a reasonable suspicion. The reason that they gathered it first was because it was not practical to leave it where it was. They would not be able to do the searches in the time with the efficiency that they needed to use.
Other side, I'd like to respond.
Part of it is that the harm comes from the initial collection. If we know we're under surveillance, our behavior changes, right? Every time that you're on Google and you hesitate before you put that search term in or you hesitate to go to that website, that does damage to the fabric of our society, the idea that there's a marketplace of ideas. So that original collection is a harm. But even with the limited number of searches, they go three hops. So it's the reasonable suspicious number, but the people they called, the people they called, and the people they called. It's like a big scoop that goes into this database, pulls out all those numbers, which could rise into the millions.
Pulls out 500 numbers. They put in 300, they brought out 500, they gave 500 numbers to the FBI. They didn't bring out a great gob of data.
We have time for one more question, so make it good. No pressure.
Hi, my name is Sue, and my question is for Mr. Baker. It seems that the heart of your argument is the sense of credible threat, that the public believe that there is a credible threat. As a journalist, I've had the privilege of talking with numerous people who do counterterrorism and journalists who cover that, and they've looked me in the eye, and they said the threat is real. In the wake of supposed WMDs in Iraq, why should the public believe the government?
I think that's a fair question. The real answer is you don't need to believe the government. Sure, the government has access to particular threats, but it doesn't take a security clearance to know that there are a lot of people who would like nothing better than to kill everybody in this auditorium. That's the world we live in, and the technology that we all enjoy has empowered them. What I'm really suggesting is that having empowered everyone and increasingly empowered people on the other side of the world who hate us to cause serious damage here, we need to let the government use the technical tools that are created by lower costs for storing data to offset the advantage that the terrorists have. It seems to me you don't have to have a security clearance to have a common sense appreciation of what the threat is and how empowered terrorists are these days.
Michael German.
We can demand accountability from our intelligence agencies, and we need to, because the only way they're going to be effective. We didn't know how bad things were on September 10th, 2001, right? So what happened now is we have less knowledge of what the intelligence community is doing and how effective it's being. That can't work. We have to have transparency. That's how we get effective government.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is, spy on me, I would rather be safe. On to round three, closing statements. Our motion is, spy on me, I'd rather be safe. And here to summarize his position against this motion, Michael German. He's Senior Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberty Union's Washington Legislative Office. Michael German, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me tonight, and thanks to Stuart and Richard for a great debate. Let me close by talking about this problem from a different standpoint. I'm hopefully the only person in this room who's actually been part of a terrorist conspiracy. So I have a little bit of insight on what terrorists want. They want you to be afraid. They know they aren't powerful enough to overthrow a government or popular enough to win an election. So their only tool is to use horrible violence to try to provoke a government into taking measures that damage itself. One of the interesting things I found working in terrorist groups, they always have a manifesto, right? They create a clandestine organization, and then the first thing they do is tell everybody in the world who they are. But the reason they do it is because they're trying to provoke grievance. So they want to let the government know who to go after. And that's what starts to undermine the government, when it starts losing its legitimacy by doing things that violate its own values. That's why I think the Founding Fathers were so genius when they created a system that inoculated against this kind of reaction, right? It made sure that the government was accountable to the people and limited in the power that it could use, particularly in violating the civil rights of Americans. What they knew wasn't that was going to be a weak form of government, but that would be the strongest government on earth. We don't need to be afraid. We need to demand accountability. We don't need to sacrifice privacy, especially for the illusion of secrecy.
Thank you, Michael German.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Western warriors ruled the seven seas, conquered continents as they pleased. War makes wealth for the West, no health or welfare for the rest. Plunder and labor and land enriched the North and Western man. Now its wealth destroys the weather. In the south, there's flood and drought. Africa pays again, no doubt. Arctic ice is melting, it's a crisis. But they're pelting us with lame excuses. It's no use. This abuse of our home, them that made the mess, got to make redress. They must. It's called justice. Big bucks for bailouts, bonuses and bombs, but not to save the earth. We're warned by ones and twos and threes. We're dying by degrees. What about the bankers and the bailers and the climate crisis failures? Give them all FEMA trailers. People need food, clothing, and glaciers, but these human rights erasures, made by criminals of climate, cheat the earth and the poor, made poor by profit, time to come off it. How long will we let our mother die while leaders stand by and lie? Stand by and lie, stand by and lie. Poison the lakes and rivers, causing cancer, that's the answer we give to the indigenous. No wonder they're not digging us. One more insult, one more injury, one more death sentence. That's when we begin to see angry mermaids, angry polar bears, angry killer whales, angry islanders, angry islands, angry islanders, angry islands, angry continents. Leave the oil in the soil, keep the coal in the hole, and the tar in the sand. Are you listening, Alberta? Are you listening in Ottawa?
And now, back to the debate. Does spying keep us safe?
Our motion is, spy on me, I'd rather be safe. And here to summarize his position supporting the motion, Richard Falkenrath, former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Falkenrath.
Thank you, John, and thank you, David and Michael, for an excellent discussion and debate. I hope the audience understands that neither Stuart nor I are in favor of an unfettered, unchecked executive authority to conduct domestic spying. That's not what we're arguing here. There is another side to this, aside from the legitimate interest in personal privacy that we all have, and it's security. And this is, as I said at my opening, not abstract, and I'll end with a brief anecdote. I was Deputy Commissioner of Counterterrorism in the New York City Police Department. We were part of the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. In September 2008, we learned of a case. We knew nothing about it until we were told, as a result of electronic surveillance, that was an individual in Denver developing a bomb and intending to transport it back to New York City for the purpose of attacking the New York City subway. We found out about that because of his electronic communication with his bomb-making trainer in Pakistan. FBI surveillance team in Denver acquired him and began surveilling him. In the course of his drive across the country with 1 to 2 kilograms of TATP explosive in his trunk, we began an investigation of his contacts, who he was in telephonic communication with. Quickly, his two key co-conspirators were identified and then subject to much higher levels of intrusive investigation. This was a real plot against the city of New York, where I was at the NYPD, and it was stopped, not entirely, but in large measure because of the techniques we were talking about here tonight. This is not abstract. There is another side to this, and it is something which is very, very valuable.
Thank you, Richard Falkenrath. Our motion, Spy on Me, I'd Rather Be Safe. And here, summarizing his position against this motion, David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Ladies and gentlemen, David Cole.
Thank you. Technology has changed the calculus of surveillance in a dramatic way. It used to be if the government wanted to find out everything about who you hung out with, what books you read, what you thought, it was very difficult, very costly for it to do so. And that was a check on the government's ability to invade our privacy. That check has gone out the window because of the Al Gore and the internet. It's now possible to learn everything about us through this third party information, which Richard Falkenrath says we shouldn't be concerned about at all. I think we need to be concerned about it. I think we can strike a proper balance between the technology that makes it possible for this kind of very, very broad surveillance and the need to find bad guys. But we can't do so if the programs are run in secret and if we haven't had an opportunity to have a democratic deliberation. And when we don't have that democratic deliberation, it seems to me it's very likely that the security people are going to go overboard on the side of security. And when they're collecting texts, they're collecting data on every text that I send to my high school daughter when I go to pick her up from school and she hasn't come out and I say, where are you? I'm here. Where are you? I'm here. Where are you? I'm here. Why does the NSA need to know that information? The only reason that they have that access to that information is because they did it in secret, because if they'd done it in public and told us they wanted to gather that information to keep us safe, I think we would have said no, and you should say no.
Thank you, David Cole. Our motion, Spy on Me, I'd Rather Be Safe. And here to summarize his position in support of this motion, Stuart Baker, the first Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. Ladies and gentlemen, Stuart Baker.
Thanks, John. When I started as General Counsel of the National Security Agency, Janet Reno, the Attorney General, came out for a visit, and this was a high-stakes meeting. She was deeply skeptical about whether this spy agency could be trusted at all. We were walking through a operations center with her when the director looked at a corporal who was going over some intercepts, and he said to the corporal, stand up, sir, and what do you do if you find a communication by an American? That corporal plucked out of a mass of people doing the intercepts, said, sir, we segregate that. We cannot disseminate it unless there's foreign intelligence in it. We must must anonymize the data and destroy it if there's no intelligence in it, which was the rule. And I thought to myself, you know, the first rule of lawyering is don't ask a question if you don't know what the answer is going to be. But the director was absolutely sure that you could pick anybody out of that agency and ask him what the rules were, he would tell you and would be proud of the fact that he knew them and would obey them. That is the culture of the National Security Agency. They are subject to lots of constraints. We cannot say all of this will be public, or we might as well not try to gather intelligence. We have to set rules, we have to count on people to enforce them, and then we have to count on the goodwill of our agencies to carry them out, because that's our only hope of being able to do intelligence under law. I think we can do it.
Thank you, Stuart Baker. And that concludes closing statements. All right, so it's all in now. I have the results. Remember, we have you vote twice, once before the debate and once again after the debate. And the team whose numbers have moved the most in percentage point terms will be declared our winner. Our motion is this: spy on me, I would rather be safe. The initial vote, before hearing the arguments, 26% of you agreed with this motion, 41% were against it, and 33% were undecided. So those are the first results. Remember, you need to move the most in percentage point terms to win this game. Here is the second vote. The team arguing for the motion, their second vote is 29%. They went from 26% to 29%. That's a 3% increase. That's the number to beat. Let's see the team against the vote. They were 41% to start. They were 62% at the end. They clearly beat that 3%. They are our winner. Our congratulations to them. The motion, spy on me, I'd rather be safe. The team arguing against it has won. Thank you from me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared U.S.
Every April it's taxes. In November it's ballots. Every time you go banking, a new form appears. And the way that it's headed, I'm gonna start shredding. 'Cause the form that I'm dreading comes every 10 years. You fill out your census with a number to pencil. First fill in your last name and then your address. But soon they start asking, are you native Alaskan? And soon this small task is becoming a mess. My mom's half Hawaiian, her dad's two-thirds Mayan, her uncle's half brother, starting boys in the hood. His aunt's Anglo-Saxon, just like Michael Jackson. What to do, I am asking, if you're Tiger Woods.
In the year 25, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 35, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 45, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew. Nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 55, your arms are hanging limp at your side. Your legs got nothing to do, some machine doing that for you. In the year 65, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son,
pick your daughter too. From the bottom of a long glass tube, whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is going to shake his mighty head. He'll either say, I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Oh, oh. In the year 95, I'm kind of wondering if man is going to be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find. In the year 3535.
Today, there is one cologne that has the smell of tin.
I smell something.
An odor that has a personality all its own.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
You can't talk to me like that.
It is schizophrenia, the cologne.
It is not schizophrenia.
Yes, it is.
Get out of my head.
Wear the cologne that asks,
who are you?
Who am I?
This stinks.
Schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia.
Who said that?
I did.
No, I didn't.
You're right. It was me.
What am I doing here?
Schizophrenia, the cologne.
Oh, yes.
Available now at hospitals, in mental wards, everywhere.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
I don't hear you.
Yes, you do. Because you are crazy.
If I am crazy, what are you?
Schizophrenia.
Ah, yes.
And now for something completely different.